This call is moving to order. I don't have a gavel, but we don't need one. Maybe next time. Anyway, we'll call us moving to order, and we do have a quorum. Oh, I don't need it anymore. Maybe to adjourn the meeting, I will. Anyway, we're going to get to talk to the Historical Society and Minnesota Public Television Association today. It's going to be a fun, interesting day, and where are the minutes? These are the minutes? Minutes of January 9th? Did you read those?
Yes, I did, Mr. Chair, and I was asked for them to be approved.
Okay. Representative Green moves the minutes of January 9th. All in favor of that signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Passes. And with that, we are going to see the Historical Society first. And we're very lucky to have the director of the Historical Society and his right-hand man, David. Welcome to our committee.
Thank
Give
you.
Give your name for the record, please.
Yes.
So the Historical Society will have it on record for 150 years.
Thank you, Chairman Gunther. Members of the committee, my name is Stephen Elliott. I'm the director and CEO of the Minnesota Historical Society. It's a pleasure to be with you this afternoon. We appreciate your taking the time to hear about the good work that's been accomplished by Minnesota's history community with the help of the Legacy Amendment funding. We're pleased to present you with a report on expenditures from the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund for history activities over the past year. This is the report. Together, we've achieved quite a bit, and we look forward to continuing our work together. The Minnesota Historical Society's mission is to use the power of history to enrich and transform lives, and we work to accomplish this every day by collecting the stories and the things that tell us about the past that provide the context for today. When the Legacy Amendment passed in 2008, the Minnesota history community gathered together to talk and dream and set a vision about what could be done with this wonderful opportunity, funding from the Legacy Amendment. We gathered in town hall meetings across the state and came up with a framework to strengthen history across the state. This framework has become the outline of how funding has been appropriated since the first legacy appropriations were made in 2009. We'll go into more detail about that in a moment. So when I say we, I'm not talking just about the Minnesota Historical Society and our staff, but also the literally hundreds of history and heritage organizations all across Minnesota that do this work. I'd like to take a moment to recognize those dozen organizations that comprise the Minnesota History Coalition and represent the individuals and organizations that preserve and present history in Minnesota today. Several of these organizations are represented here today. I appreciate Pat Emerson being here from the Council for Minnesota Archaeology, Sarah Hansen of the White Bear Lake Area Historical Society, who's here representing the Minnesota Alliance of Local History Museums, Scott Pollock from the American Swedish Institute, representing the Minnesota Association of Museums, and Molly Huber from the Minnesota Digital Library. At the end of our presentation, we'll discuss our request for the next biennium, but first, David Kelleher, a director of public policy, will provide a brief review of the structure and accomplishments of the past biennium. David.
Welcome to our committee, David.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm David Kelleher, Minnesota Historical Society. What I'd like to do is take a couple of quick minutes and walk you through the structure of how Legacy Amendments funds for History and the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund have been structured since the amendment was passed in 2008. And this slide really gives you a good snapshot of how those funds have been structured. Of course, we look first to the language in the Constitution, which says, to preserve Minnesota's history and cultural heritage. We think that's pretty cool that the words to preserve Minnesota's history are in the Constitution, and then we look to the appropriation language that you all write each biennium for those appropriations. And the way that has been structured since the first appropriation, you can see in this org chart with five of the major areas that the appropriations have been put into. So the three on the left of that diagram are the largest of those three. And the first one is the grants program, and I'll spend a couple of minutes walking through that. The statewide programs, which are programs primarily operated by the Minnesota Historical Society, the partnership category, where organizations work together, combining financial resources or experience in the field, and then a statewide survey of archaeological and historic sites, and finally the Minnesota Digital Library. So I'll take a couple of minutes to walk through each of the major categories that have been provided for the funding. The Historical and Cultural Heritage Grants Program, long way of saying grants that go to local and other history organizations to carry out the work that they do to preserve and promote history. This is a competitive grants program. It's reviewed by a citizen committee, the Historic Resources Advisory Committee, that is a volunteer committee. And over the life of this grants program since 2009, we have made nearly 2,000 grants in all 87 counties to 724 different organizations. So there's been a lot of experience and capacity building and preservation that's happened since that time. These are broken into a couple of categories, small grants and large grants. The smaller grants are available on a rotating basis, rolling basis for getting those dollars out to organizations quickly so that they can do their work. And then the larger grants are done once each year by that Historic Resources Advisory Committee. You see in this image a picture of the Historic Resources Advisory Committee doing their work, reviewing applications. They hear from each grant application and then deliberate on the funding available that they are responsible for. In 2016, those members volunteered 564 hours of their own time to help make this happen. And we're trying to make their work and the work of applicants easier with a paperless application system so that they don't get stacks of paper. This map shows where the grants have gone over the life of the Legacy Amendment. Again, nearly 2,000 grants in all 87 counties, and it's been a great array across the state where this work has taken place. Secondly, the second major program is statewide history programs, which are programs primarily operated by the Minnesota Historical Society. We break those into our mission statement, preserving, sharing, connecting. And there's a couple of examples on each of these following slides that give you an idea of the work that we've been doing at the History Center and at historic sites across the state with Minnesota Historical Society staff. Exhibits at the History Center and outside, Minipedia are some further examples of those areas, curriculum development, diversity outreach, and intern programs. And I would mention also in the book that we've distributed to you, that has a full accounting of the projects. Each of the grants that have been made are outlined with a short description of what the project has accomplished, how much the grant was for, and where it's located. And similarly, on the tab statewide programs, there are descriptions of each of the programs that the Minnesota Historical Society runs. I mentioned earlier partnerships. This is a category that the History Coalition had recommended back in 2008-2009 as a way for history organizations, sometimes big, sometimes small, and sometimes organizations that are not thought of as traditionally history organizations, but these organizations can come together to share resources and share expertise to do a project and learn from each other. Next is a program for surveys with the idea that we need to know what's out there in archaeological and historic sites. So those surveys are conducted either on a geographical basis, taking a look at a county or a different geographical area or by theme, where more intensive look will take place for a series of archaeological or historic resources to get that base of knowledge in place so that when other work is done, we know what is out there. And the slide gives you some examples of what's happened this past fiscal year. And finally, the Minnesota Digital Library is a collaboration between Minitex, Minnesota Historical Society, and other history partners where different types of collections are digitized and made available online for people anywhere to access. The Historic Recognition Grants Program was a program that was in last year's, or 2 years ago, appropriation this biennium that was centered around Minnesota's role in the Civil War. And we just finished up a great effort to commemorate the Civil War. The Civil War Commemoration Task Force chair is here. Representative Erdahl was the co-chair of that group, and some great work was accomplished by local history organizations and the Minnesota Historical Society through that effort. Finally, the Minnesota History Coalition, the groups that Steve named earlier, is requesting funding for the next biennium, and there's a sheet that's in your packet that looks like this that outlines what we are requesting for the upcoming biennium. Our goal is, based on the projections from the last forecast, a third of the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund, and it's broken into those same categories that we've used the past several biennia. And this sheet gives you some background information on how the grants program, for example, would be administered and some of the justification for the request, the return on investment, and the work that's been done and the value of history and why history is important. So, Mr. Chair, with that quick overview, we would be happy to answer any questions. Steve, I don't know if you have anything to add to that, but we very much appreciate the support that the legislature and this committee have provided for history. The dollars have gone across the state and been used by many organizations and many people and been put to good use. So we appreciate the ongoing support.
Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a few questions. I see that in the last biennium you received, was it $29 million? Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Green, that sounds about right. Yes.
Yes.
$13,985,000 in the first year of the biennium, $15 million in the second year of the biennium.
So, Mr. Chair, and then so you got a substantial increase here, I'm wondering if you don't get the full funds, is there other sources that you would have available to you to go after these projects?
Mr. Chair, Representative
Kelleher,
the grants program, if funding is less than this year, there would be fewer grants that would go out to history organizations unless history work would be accomplished. I think it's a very complex mix of funding with all those dozens and hundreds of organizations on the grant side, and then on the Minnesota Historical Society side, we also have a complex mix of funding that goes into the work that we do. So less work would be accomplished, obviously, with fewer resources, but we would do as much work as we could with the funds that are provided.
Okay. Mr. Chair, do you guys have any kind of a set-aside or a fallback plan? Because it looks like this year we're projected to be less in the legacy funds, and I don't know if any of us really know where that's going to be, but last year, or last biennium, we ran into some problems with not enough funds to go out for what we were trying to allocate. Do you have any kind of a backup yourself?
Mr. Chair, Representative
Kellen,
we obviously have been watching the projections for sales tax that go through the legacy fund, and yes, those dollars are flat. Again, with the grants program, we would have If there were fewer dollars provided, we would have less dollars that would go out into grants programs, and we would, on the statewide program side, we would have fewer activities we would be able to fund. And we'll keep an eye on this committee, obviously, and the projections in the February forecast. So I'm not sure if that answers your question. We're watching closely to see what funds are available in the projections to see how the budgeting goes.
Mr. Chair, well, I guess the question is kind of, I should have been a little more blunt. I would hate to see you start something and then, because the funds aren't there, not have enough to finish it and end up with a half or partially finished project. And that's why I'm wondering if there's any kind of reserve that you have, or maybe you're not able to, but do you keep a reserve within your funds in case of those situations?
No. If there is less money there, fewer projects would be approved. New projects would not be approved. Other projects wrap up and be finished.
Director Elliott, does your $43 million include the 5% reserves?
That's in the Minnesota History Coalition. Mr. Chair, I'm not sure. We've been trying to figure out the right number, which would be the entire projected amount of the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. I think that amount is based on 100%, not 95%, if that makes sense. So I think we may want to go back and make sure that we have the right number based on your intent to appropriate 95% of the available dollars. So we'll double-check that.
That would be appropriate. I think that way we won't run into the problem, potentially, right, that Representative Green brought up.
Mr. Chair, Representative Green, I would add also that we recognize that the appropriation language for the Legacy Fund says that these are one-time appropriations, and we have acted accordingly and recognize that these are not expected to be ongoing funds into the future. And for the grants program, those are grants that happen periodically, and for programs that we operate, we recognize they're one-time appropriations.
Okay. Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is one more question. I'll just roll into one. You've got a couple of issues that came up on the legislative auditor's report in your grant monitoring and also your administrative costs. And I won't ask you to go into them because I think we've discussed them before, unless somebody else wants to hear them. But have you guys taken steps to remedy those? Are they satisfactory now?
Mr. Chair, Representative Green, on the 2015 report from the legislative auditor, there were two findings. One of them related to a series of grants that were legislatively designated grants or pass-throughs. In the case of that one, we have taken care of that. Since that was a one-time grant, three different organizations were involved in that. Those went to a different pass-through organization, so we will not have to deal with those in the future. But before those dollars went out, we made sure that the recommendations that the legislative auditor were suggesting to us were fulfilled. So that one is. The second one is the administrative cost. I know that this committee and other committees have heard from the legislative auditor. There's an ongoing conversation about that and the difference of opinion between MMB and their guidance and the legislative auditor. We've been involved in those conversations. We were part of a meeting with MMB. We were part of a meeting with the legislative auditor, and I think the legislative auditor stated to you and to the Senate committee that they want to work with you to figure out a longer-term solution to that. We have differing opinions between the legislative auditor and MMB. We're sort of caught in the middle on the methodology, and we're trying to work with all of them to figure that out. So I guess the second one is an ongoing conversation.
Anyone else has questions? Representative?
No, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And just, I guess, some comments. Certainly the administrative cost issue we've run into many times will be an issue that we just keep on talking about, I think, because the auditor said that funds for administration shall be necessary for and directly related to. And certainly there's some gray areas in that, but you know, having a hard percentage was difficult as well. And so we were trying to reach some type of accommodation in between there, and I'm guessing that the questions will keep coming as we go into the future. Regarding the 5%, changing, well, the first time that I chaired this committee, I sound like Lyndon Carlson. The first time that I chaired this committee, in the spirit of generosity, we dipped into that 5% so that we could get more money out, and it worked. We had such revenues that worked. Then when I became chair again, and we did that again, still leaving something in the reserve but going below the 5, we did not anticipate the shortage in revenue that would transpire. And so the recommendation of going into the future after experiencing it both ways is that we be sure to maintain that 5% cushion into the future. And it was by category. You know, 5% in the Outdoor Heritage Fund, 5% in the Waters Fund, and in the other two as well. So not exactly 5% for each of the recipients. But anyway, that's my recommendation.
Representative Wagenius, I'm sorry I missed you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Different kind of question here. When I think of history, I think of collecting things that are old and preserving them, and you all do a remarkably good job at that. But one of the things I'm hearing about more is people's interest in what people ate years ago. And you can't collect that. But how do we educate, or maybe you're doing this and I'm missing it, how do we educate folks about, say, what did the people at Fort Snelling eat? What did the soldiers eat? Because people are interested in these kinds of things now, when I would say 10 years ago, not a whit.
It's a very interesting, may I ask? Thank you. Very interesting question. And I think we can't always anticipate what questions people in the future will be asking about history. Probably the first best advice for ourselves is to collect as wisely and broadly as we can so that the resources are there, so that knowledgeable people can go to those sources in the future to answer questions like this. So to learn about what people ate, there are any number of historical sources in our collections that would inform answers to that. What people's letters and diaries and journals, newspaper accounts, and we've got most every newspaper of record ever published in the state of Minnesota. The objects themselves that people used and kept. So I think we have source archaeological findings, because what remains in the pits of privies tell us what people ate. And we've got some of the remains, and we've got all the reports on these things. So I think most of you, I hope, have visited the History Center and been into our collections area. We have lots of different types of material that would help to answer that question and probably many other questions that today we can't anticipate.
I could follow up, Mr. Chair.
Representative Wagenius.
That's good if you're a researcher, but I'm talking about the person who just goes to a site and says, well, what were they eating? What did they grow? What were they finding in nature, the natural history? So it's not, I don't have any doubt about the resources you have. What I I'm trying to figure out is how do we tell the whole story mm-hmm. of what it was like in Minnesota 150 years ago or 200 years ago. And I don't think we can tell the whole story about if we can't talk about the most basic thing, what people eat. And it's just that this is really, just think of how we're talking about food differently than we did 10 years ago. So it's how we talk to people today about what went on back then.
Richard.
If I may. Thank you, sir. The researchers that use those sources present the basic information that then we can use to respond to questions and to talk about that important aspect of life and other aspects of life that our interpreters draw upon in talking with people when they visit our sites. One of our publishing emphases is on food topics. We do a lot of public programming around food, both with small groups and at our site. So, you know, there are lots of channels and media for responding to the public interest in something like that. And I hope that we can do that competently, not just with that question, but with other ones.
Representative Lehman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I hope that this is a simple question, and I just want a simple answer. Going back to Representative Green's question about your request for last year versus your request for this year, it's $29 million last year was what you received, and then the request for this year is $43 million from the Arts and Culture Heritage Fund. So my question is, what was the amount that you asked for last time? Did you ask for more than $29 million? And then can you just give me a kind of a simple explanation of the difference? It looks like part of it goes for programming at the Historical Society, part of it goes for grants. So I'm thinking maybe the programming doesn't get cut. If the appropriation is less than what you request, maybe it's the grants that get cut. So two-part question, why the big difference, and then what do you do as a result of the?
Mr. Killer.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lehman. The History Coalition, the broad group that Steve mentioned earlier, has often requested a third of the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund, and we have not gotten up to that level. We have been around a quarter, 25% to 30%. So that's our goal, and our request in the last biennium was a similar level. If the amounts, similar answer to the question from Representative Green, if the amounts are not appropriated at that level and are appropriated at a similar level to last biennium, we would have that amount that would go out in grants, that would go out to history organizations across the state, and we would do that level of work with the Minnesota Historical Society's activities at historic sites in the History Center.
Thank you.
Representative Lewis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Elliott, thank you for coming today, and thank you for all the work you do. I was wondering how much it would, if you would have money to, if we started a program for all 10th graders to be able to read the book Uprising, and apparently there's quite a bit of interest in 10th graders or 11th graders to, as they're developing their hormones and whatnot, and knowledge of Minnesota to read the book Uprising. Would you be able to fund such an endeavor?
If somebody submitted a grant request for that and it went through the competitive rounds for funding, then we would be delighted to have secondary students read good historical literature.
Mr. Chair, thank you, Mr. Elliott, for playing for a second.
Playing, sorry.
Important piece of literature, indeed. I noticed you had strategically placed all of the said author's books up at the store that you have at the History Center. We were up there the other day for St. Paul Days, and I noticed that you had five of them up there. And anyways, might have some additional copies if more to sell. Anyways, I think you've been good stewards in the past of the money, the legacy money, and I just wonder if there's some things that have kind of jumped out this last cycle and that you didn't expect, you know, some of these smaller grants, and maybe you could tell us the stories. I know you do the big things like the I didn't see the football thing, but the then, now, wow was, I think that was helped with legacy money. And then I don't know if did the Hmong event that you had, did that have, I thought that was really quite amazing, and the public seemed real popular, at least the communities that I represent, and thank you for doing that. And then I don't know if legacy money was involved with the ebony, the fashion one that you had through there, but I thought that was really, I was lucky. I think David actually took me in there one day or somebody, but it was really quite a collection. And I know that was a kind of a short thing, but was that funded by with legacy money? Maybe you can answer that. And then, but I think you need to maybe do a better job of, and I know you're trying, because I noticed that you put the signs up and of what's funded by legacy, but just always it'll be helpful as we go through this so that the public knows and continues to know. I know you're trying to do that, but you can always do more. So I'd be curious to hear if there's any like small grants that just kind of jumped out that you were just really pleased with that, you know, that were around the state. It doesn't have to be, just be curious if there's a couple little stories you could tell us.
If I may?
Really?
Thank you. Mr. Chair, Representative Lilly, yes, I accept your encouragement to get the word out, continue to get the word out on legacy funding. We certainly want the public to appreciate the fact that this funding supports important work, and there's usually legacy money involved in exhibit initiatives at the History Center. It is remarkable to look at the grant requests that come from these hundreds of grassroots history and heritage organizations and from our history partners, because there's a great diversity in those projects, and they have to do with everything from research and education initiatives to things that some organizations can do with their own collections to be better stewards of how they're stored and preserved and made accessible to the public. Sometimes some legacy funding is used to take a look at a historic structure and do the analysis, the history and the analysis of the structure, and understand better what work is needed to preserve the structure. The flexibility of the funding and the process allows for a wide range of things to be considered that are really important in these communities all around the state. It's hard to pick out a favorite child, but I can tell you there are a lot of folks that are really thankful that this funding is available for this kind of work all across the state.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you,
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good afternoon, gentlemen. This is not directly related to the legacy fund, although it could be, I suppose. I would like to have an update on the Fort Snelling situation. We know there's an important anniversary coming up, and I'm curious about how that whole process is coming along.
Director.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Torkelson. I'm delighted to have a moment to speak about the Fort Snelling project because it is so important to the people of Minnesota. The Fort Snelling is the historic site that was Minnesota's first national historic landmark. It is where the oldest non-native structure in the state is, the Round Tower, the oldest residence in the state of Minnesota, the Commandant's House. It's remarkable that so many segments of that original fort that work began on in 1820 have survived. And the research and restoration behind the Fort Snelling project in the 60s and 70s was just a remarkable project. And If you scroll ahead from that 1820 date, the bicentennial of what many may consider to be Minnesota's most important historic site is coming up in 2020, and it is our goal to have a new visitor center in one of the 1904 cavalry barracks that we are charged to preserve there that's currently just being mothballed, to deepen and broaden the history stories that are told there, and to reposition historic Fort Snelling as the site of national historic significance that it is. The stories that can be told there over millennia relate to major themes in the story of American history. And with the legislature's help, we have completed pre-design. Because there was no bonding bill last year, we have taken some of the privately raised money to continue to the design work so that if there is a successful appropriation and a bonding bill this session, we can get the work done for Fort Snelling's bicentennial in 2020. And that will be very, very important to us, and we think to this major site in Minnesota. Is that responsive, sir, to your question?
Well, you had to bring up bonding, didn't you?
I have to every chance I get.
No, and I believe you've been doing some private fundraising in relation to that project, and I'm curious if there is any consideration to apply any legacy funds to that project.
If I may, sir. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Torkelson. Yes, the policy and practice over the years has been that the state has funded all of the needed capital work on the more than 140 buildings on the historic sites that we're stewards of. But because Fort Snelling means so much to so many people, we were confident that we could raise some private money to go along with the state appropriation for the work at Fort Snelling. And I think we were right. There's been great public interest in this, and the private fundraising has gone very well. But we have not contemplated diverting legacy money to this. I think that you know, in keeping with the longstanding policy, you know, this bricks and mortar work should be funded the way that it's normally been funded, as opposed to cannibalizing and reducing the amount of funding available for these other history projects all around the state. And we much prefer to keep it to the bonding bill and privately raise money specifically for the Fort Snelling work. David, why don't you speak to that? That's a good point.
Mr. Chair, Representative Torkelson, with the question of using legacy funds for the Fort Snelling project, we also want to be very cognizant of the constitutional requirement of supplement, substitute. And while we have used legacy funds for some limited research projects and collections management projects, we want to be careful not to use those dollars for the main project in a way that would violate that constitutional requirement.
Thank you.
Thank you. Since we talked about Representative Erdahl's book and we're on television today, I think that should at least have maybe in one of the next meetings somebody bring treats. I think that would be very appropriate.
Second.
I could read the book to you.
Oh. That could be a treatment.
Oh, okay.
Any other questions from members? This has been a very enlightening conversation, and I appreciate it very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Next, we have Minnesota Public Television Association. Welcome, Mr. Prashinsky.
We have a new building with nothing in it.
Absolutely.
We can have a new building with nothing in it because it will be.
Come on.
Welcome to our committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Trying to get our technology lined up here for a presentation. I'm Bill Straczynski, and I'm here today, and I represent the Friends of Minnesota Public Television, and thank you for this opportunity to share with you our pretty exciting story, I think, and hopefully you will agree with that. In fact, I'm pretty confident you will agree with that when you see the things we've accomplished thanks to this committee's fine work for the last several years. Public television serves everybody in Minnesota. Every citizen can reach gets our signal. Every citizen can make themselves available about the program that we produce and we provide. And our stations are located in your communities in the Bemidji, Brainerd area, and Moorhead, Fargo, Appleton, Granite Falls, Montevideo area, southwestern Minnesota, and Austin covers southeastern Minnesota, Duluth, northeastern Minnesota, and certainly the Twin Cities through TPT. So we've got a strong and rich tradition of providing quality programming. We think that you are a benefit to the citizens under this legacy amendment. And, Mr. Chairman, so it's my pleasure. I want to introduce, first of all, Jim Pagliarini from TPT, who's representing the association today, and then Les Heen will be coming up after in a little bit. Les Heen is the CEO of Pioneer Public Television in southwestern Minnesota to give you a little bit more local flavor of how they do things in greater Minnesota. And so at this point, I'd like to turn it over to Mr. Pagliarini.
Sure. Thanks, Bill.
Welcome to our committee, Mr. Pagliarini.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I think what we're set up to do first is to entertain you, but also inform you with about a 6-minute video. So if that's ready to roll. Ashley, this is Ashley Rowe, who is our kind of project lead for our arts programming in Twin Cities PBS.
I think because of the Historical Society, I think we better have your name. Could you give us your name so what you have on the record, please?
Sure. My name is Jim Pagliarini, and I'm the president and CEO of Twin Cities PBS.
Being an artist in Minnesota is a privilege, an honor, and a true joy.
Public television, it makes art accessible to anyone.
The Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund has made it possible for the 6 stations of the Minnesota Public Television Association to create, broadcast, distribute, and stream unique, culturally diverse series, documentaries, and specials about the arts, music, culture, and history of our state. The MPTA has produced more than 750 hours of legacy-funded programming and broadcast more than 13,000 hours since 2009. Our statewide broadcasts alone reach 4.7 million households. More people are learning about the arts, music, culture, and history in Minnesota because of public television's legacy work on air, online, in classrooms, and in our communities. And we're making an impact. More than 14,000 artists from all cultures and backgrounds have been featured. Artists report they're selling more work as a result. And viewers tell us they're spending more on the arts, attending more arts events, and contributing more to their local economies because of our programs. Millions beyond Minnesota are discovering local artists and learning about our diverse communities because of national distribution to PBS stations. Legacy programs from WDSE and Lakeland Public Television exploring local Native American culture and history are broadcast on the First Nations Experience Channel to 22 million U.S. households. Minnesota Original is now airing on 195 public television stations in 37 states. The Twin Cities PBS Arts and Cultural Series is broadcast to 65% of the country, equaling more than 75 million U.S. households. The MPTA is making an impact online. Our nearly 750 hours of legacy-funded digital content has more than 11 million views from across the world. Hello, Montevideo. Pioneer Public Television's documentary connecting students with those in its South American sister city received national recognition for engaging youth through media and inspired an international TV commercial production in Minnesota. Legacy content is free to stream and share. With millions of social media impressions every year, Minnesota artists and stories are generating growing online engagement. Our story examining the power of music through one of the country's first choirs for those living with Alzheimer's was shared by PBS. Tens of thousands joined the Facebook conversation that led to an international collaboration. The stations of the MPTA go beyond broadcast and digital experiences to connect directly with audiences. Thousands have attended screenings, discussions, performances, and events around legacy programs. The MPTA's valuable resources include its digital content libraries and more than 850 educator and activity guides, online and free for every student and teacher. Prairie Public Broadcasting's Teacher Training Institute provides cross-curricular resources and professional development. Lesson plans for Lake Superior communities are based on local history featured in WDSE documentaries, and area schools are using KSMQ's Beyond the Bully.
Public television is shaping the way that my students are viewing art and artists, as well as their community.
Twin Cities PBS is partnering with St. Paul Public Schools, leading digital storytelling workshops around which teachers are developing curriculum.
St. Paul Public Schools, we have about 39,000 kids that speak 125 dialects and languages. Public television provides real-world context for our kids. It's an incredible resource.
We raise people who want to be artists here. I think that we attract people who want to be artists here. We have a huge community of people who are hungry to engage with art in different ways.
Legacy makes it possible for our statewide team to create this award-winning body of work every year. Legacy programs have been recognized with 59 Emmys and many more accolades, including a 2014 Legacy Partner Award. The MPTA seeks to continue to create, broadcast, distribute, and stream more programs and materials that are valuable for artists, students, educators, and all Minnesotans, and to continue documenting and celebrating our experiences in the arts, music, culture, and history that are Minnesota's legacy.
I love that it's called Legacy because this is our mark at this time. This is what we have to bring to this moment, to this community.
We're going to get to see it again.
It's so good. Just to see it twice. Once again, I'm Jim Pollyrini, the president of Twin Cities PBS, and it's a position that I've held now for about 20 years. It's a real privilege for me to be here with Bill and my colleague Les Heen from Pioneer Public Television, representing the Minnesota Public Television Association. And I want to thank you all again for giving us the opportunity to share with you the ways we have put the funding from this committee and the citizens of Minnesota, I hope you will agree, to good use. So you just saw what I thought was a great video to try to encapsulate in about 6 minutes the excitement, the reach, the impact of the work that we have done in collaboration with hundreds and hundreds of artists and arts organizations across the state. We've also provided the committee with an extensive printed report that is full of numbers that talk about the impact of our work, economic, the number of people we're reaching, the number of arts and artists that we've worked with over the years. So I am not going to be repetitive and regurgitate those numbers for you, but I think you'll agree it's pretty impressive. I just have 3 points to make as you consider, as you evaluate the work that we've done in the past and evaluate how we've been good stewards of the public funding, and as you begin to contemplate how you're going to apply your funding for the coming year. So first, to reiterate something Bill Straczynski mentioned in his introduction, is that the funds that we receive reach and touch every corner and every citizen of this state. We are fortunate in Minnesota to have six independent public television stations that are owned and operated within the communities within which they operate. That's not true in all cases. A lot of states have a large station, like Twin Cities PBS, that gets all the money and makes all the decisions. Here in Minnesota, we have people on the ground who know the community, who know the arts, the artists, and the cultural organizations, and can put the funding they use to good use. So the impact of this funding is truly statewide, and as you saw, it reaches millions. There's economic impact through the creation of jobs at our station, and we're hearing more and more anecdotal evidence about the benefit to the arts, artists, and our cultural organizations, selling more artwork and having more attendance because of the kind of exposure that we can give them. And there's also an impact on children, as you saw, as these materials are used in classrooms all throughout the state of Minnesota. The second point is to kind of give you a perspective of how we view ourselves in public media and public television within the broader arts and cultural community. We think of ourselves as being the biggest stage in Minnesota. And we use that stage, which is created by the power and the reach of media, to connect, convene, engage, and inspire. Public television stations are not on that stage, nor are we center stage. Others are. So our role is to act as a catalyst and a curator to shine a light on and amplify the good work that goes on in the state within the arts and cultural community. As you saw, since this fund was established, we've invited over 14,000 artists and arts organization onto the state's biggest stage, and they have come from just about every community in the state, big and small. And you will find no more diverse and inclusive programming anywhere. And what perhaps sets us apart from just about any other stage is that we don't have a box office. The admission is free and everyone is welcome. So people who could never afford, or maybe they never even contemplated or think about going to see a performance or a dance performance, can have a front row seat. And then I'll highlight one more facet of the work that we do. We also think ourselves as preservationists. Each year, with every new artist, every new performance, every new history documentary we produce, we are building a remarkable library of the arts and cultural scene of Minnesota. And it's a library that I'm confident is going to grow in value over time as future generations watch, learn from, and are inspired by what they see. This is an investment that's going to pay dividends for many years to come. My third and last point takes us out of the state of Minnesota and focuses on the impact that this work is having beyond the physical boundaries of the state. The first piece of good news, which you heard in the documentary, is there are public television stations all over America now carrying programs that are produced in Minnesota and highlighting the arts organizations and artists. We are also very aggressively using the Internet to distribute the programs that we produce, and as you know, the Internet has no boundaries. So as an example, just this past year, over 300,000 views the Minnesota Original Programming had 300,000 views from people outside of the United States from all across the world. So each day and each month and each year, more and more people are being exposed to the rich arts and cultural communities in Minnesota because of the work that you support and we do. And I think that's very, very important to the future of our state. I know when I recruit people to come to Minnesota, after I tell them that winter's not that bad, not to worry about it, I direct them really to the Minnesota Original website and some of the history documentaries that the MPT stations have produced. I point them to some of the music shows that we've produced, and they begin to see what an incredible state we live in. They often have heard, of course, of the Guthrie and the Walker, but through the programs we produce and distribute through the MPTA, they gain a much deeper and richer understanding of what makes this place special, a great place to live, raise a family, and work. And if you talk to any top CEO in the community, they're going to tell you that the arts plays an important role in attracting and retaining a bright, thoughtful, and diverse workforce that will sustain Minnesota for generations. So we have many more stories to tell and artists to invite onto our stage. We are grateful that you and the citizens of Minnesota have given us the resources to do this work. And I hope you agree it's a good investment and one worth continuing to make. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Representative Erdahl, any questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just had a quick question. So the programming that is a national appeal, do you have any examples of some that you've sent out nationally?
If you don't mind, I will ask Ashley to come up who can speak authoritatively about the ones that have gotten the most views and attention.
Welcome to our committee. Give your name for the record, please, Ashley.
Good afternoon. My name is Ashley Rowe. One such program that went to national, well, we have a collection of Minnesota original episodes. There are about 20 or so that are airing through American Public Television and now also on the World Channel. But what really is important, I think, is the reach that through broadcast and digital. One piece that you saw highlighted in the reel was a piece about the Giving Voice Chorus. And when PBS shared that piece online, it went tens of thousands of people commented on the video and asked the organization about how to start an Alzheimer's chorus in their own communities. And one such arts programmer in Vancouver came to Minnesota to meet with the organizers of the Giving Voice Chorus. And I'm pleased to report that a new Alzheimer's chorus is set to premiere in February in Vancouver. So it's the impact that we're making by being credible and visible to others around the world. That's one such example.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I see you're more than Big Bird now.
Talking to me or her? One program that was actually financed in mostly by legacy money got some play, I think, a couple of years ago. The Past Is Alive Within Us. How did that get any national distribution, or how did that one do?
I believe that it did not go national, but we've just been pushing for that as of late, this last biennium. But the piece is online and is used in classrooms that we know and has had views from all over the world as well.
Thank you.
Any questions? Mr. Heen, welcome to our committee.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And again, for the record, my name is Les Heen, and I'm the general manager of Pioneer Public Television. Between the video and Jim's comments here, you've got a great overview of what's going on in Legacy. And one of the points that Jim had mentioned is that it reaches all corners of the state. And I guess you could say that's where I come in, because the territory that Pioneer serves includes the southwestern corner of the state, from the southwestern cities of Laverne and Worthington all the way north, all the way up to Detroit Lake. So we reach a pretty large area. And one of the ways that I gauge impact on programs is just in conversations with people. Last week on a Wednesday, I was having coffee with a retired farmer that I've known for about 30 years, and I said, so what do you like to watch on Pioneer? What programs do you like to watch? And he said, Postcards. That's the legacy-funded program that we've had week after week for the last several years. I didn't have to prod him for an idea. I didn't have to give him a list. That's what he said. And he said he likes to watch it because it's about stories about his communities. It's about things like a photographer in Pipestone who's doing very rare photographs using an old process called wet plate photography. It's about stories like the town baseball exhibit at the Murray County Museum in Slayton. It's about the Riversong Festival in Hutchinson. It's about those kinds of stories that, frankly, he's not going to see anywhere else, about his communities and about the stories and about the histories, and about stories of struggle as well. I know one of the stories that we ran in the last year was about the history of Michael Dowling and the enormous struggles that he had early on, and what an important figure he became in Minnesota history. Those are the stories that we like to do, stories of small-town life and history and arts, and it does have an impact. Jim mentioned a moment ago, of course, that there are people from outside Minnesota who see these. I remember a few years ago, one of our local artists said that someone had watched one of our stories online, heard about it from someone, And when she was going from Wisconsin, where she's visiting relatives, back to Colorado, she drove through a small town in Minnesota specifically so she could meet a particular artist and buy that kind of art. Often we don't hear about that in a it's tough to gather all of those stories, but we know that's happening. That's really important for the people in our communities. I asked one of our folks on our community advisory board, and all of us have community advisory boards, for some examples about our stories and the difference they make. And here's what she said. She said, the program about the history of local parks should increase awareness of how decisions and actions taken years ago, such as the decision to build and maintain local parks, has an impact on us today. The value is a good lesson for viewers of all ages. And then she went on to say that she's visited some parks that she didn't know were around before, and she's going to those parks because she's seen them on public television. Also in the past year, for example, we did a partnership with the University of Morris, and it was a history of a local fire department. And, of course, you only have so many people in one local fire department, but I'm sure that many other firefighters throughout communities, all throughout our area, volunteer firefighters, watched that and saw some of their story and what was going on there. As you know, last summer we also had, we saw it in the video clip there, we had crews that have been going out doing many stories, including one about the relationship between Montevideo, Minnesota, and Montevideo, Uruguay, and the history of that sister city relationship. And what I really loved about doing that was that we were able to take a look at kids. We had kids in both communities talking to each other and learning about cultures. So it's another good example of the work that we can do. Now, these are just a few examples. I don't want to take up too much of your time, but these are the kind of things that we believe are important and the stories that make differences in our communities. So thank you. With that, I'll stand for questions.
Thank you. Any questions from members? We'll go with Mr. Lilly first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm a big fan of your products, especially the Minnesota originals. Everyone I've seen, I've just really enjoyed and just thought it was fun. It's, you know, many of them are in stuff that I didn't know anything about or arts areas of interest, and it just really captivates you. And next thing you know, and then you're watching the next one, and it kind of grabs you, and you know, you just kind of keep going. I was excited to hear about the postcards. I wasn't familiar with your thing, so I got a And then the fancy little toy here, and was Googling your site, and then 8 seasons, I didn't realize, and a lot of programs, and one of them just kind of popped out. It was about that famous popcorn stand and then incorporating art out in Granite Falls. I've heard of the popcorn stand, and so now that one for sure I just want to take a look at. So thank you for your good work. I think you've been good stewards of the legacy money, and I know for sure that the originals, that people are definitely watching them and enjoying them.
You any Representative Erdl?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I've been familiar with the postcards series as well. Very good. I'm still waiting for the one on the biggest ball of twine made by one man in Darwin. So put that down on your list. Mr. Heen, you have. I wonder the status of your moving from Appleton to Granite Falls.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Erdahl. The status there is that our goal is to move over the course of 2017. The building is under construction right now, we've got a lot of the brick and the stone out on the outside of the building. And so sometime over the course of 2017, we hope to be moved in, and perhaps by a year from now, hope to have everything done.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, I might add that we are waiting for, there was funding for the equipment for that particular facility for public television in the bonding bill last year. We are hopeful that something will happen soon so that we can finish that particular project. I know Chair Torkelson fought very hard to make all that happen, and we appreciate his support. And we've now introduced legislation again to try and secure some of that funding. It's really important. But thank you.
Thank you. Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are there other testifiers? Or
we have one back there.
I'll wait until the testifiers are done.
Okay. Mr. Hughes, would you like to come down here now?
Thank you, Mr.
Tell us what you have to say.
Thank you.
I got long legs, sorry. Oh.
Good afternoon, Chairman Gunther, members of the committee. My name is Mark Hughes, and you've seen me roam these halls for many years, and we can continue to do that, I hope. But I also, by trade, I'm a broadcaster, and I have a little show called Disability Viewpoints, which is in its 19th year and won 8 national awards. But when you think of Jim Pellegrini and some of the quality class folks at TPT and Minnesota Public Television, Jim came up to me one day and said, Mark, why can't we get you started over here? And I said, Jim, I'm not smart. What do you mean? He said, have your show broadcast over here. And I had done it at CTV for all those years. Still do, but it's fed over the Minnesota Public Television Station through TPT. But that's the opportunity that Jim Pellegrini gave me. And I know that a lot of the legacy funds is to produce shows like MNO at TPT. But what you don't know, and I wish this committee would, and Jim, I don't want to invite people without you knowing, but I wish this committee would take a tour of the facility now that it's been remodeled and revamped. It's really first class and outstanding. But there's a gentleman, there's a lot of people that come to mind that I could talk about, but one is outstanding. We have a photographer, he's a studio and a field photographer, Michael Phelps. Michael Phelps and I have always hit it off. Now, people get a little nervous when we're in the studio together because we have a lot of fun. But he has won a National Emmy Award, and I'm proud of that because he's a local guy that has done it all by himself and knows how to work technology. You could send him out in a van, and that guy could do anything, but he's won a National Emmy Award. But I want you to know those are the kind of people that are in-house over there. And while I'm not there every day, what I'm doing when the Student Society membership people are invited, and I happen to be one, I'm just a small cog in the wheel, I'm actually going to school and been educated. That means that we've had presentations with Don Shelby, Bill Moyers has been there, different things like that. So when I'm in there at night, instead of, I'm saying hi and shaking hands to all the people I can, but I'm also learning something. And that's the opportunity that Jim Pellegrini and your legacy funds has given me. I've also asked this committee, the legacy funds, in years gone by for some financial help for my show Disability Viewpoints so it can continue to be played over there, and maybe I can someday move the whole operation over there. But my point today is to let you know how important this operation is in downtown St. Paul, how important it is to St. Paul and our economy. It's got a lot of jobs in there, and I hope you'll support it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mark. You've done a lot of good things for the state, too. Thank you. Okay. Representative Green.
Yeah, the panel wants to come back up, and I'll ask a couple of questions if that's what's left here. Mr. Chair, you called Minnesota Public Television, and a lot of folks around the state, including myself a few years ago, believed that you were actually owned by the state and you were a public entity. But in fact, you're not. You're a private entity. And so, you're coming for funds, and I've seen some of the stuff that you do, so I'm not going to question that. But I am going to ask you some questions. When we fund state agencies, they're asked to come in with their budgets, and so we know what their managers make and what their payroll is. Do you guys have that information accessible too?
Yeah, absolutely. So we and most of the other stations are 501c3 organizations. So all of our 990 reports disclose salaries, that disclose large contributors. We can make them available to you, and they're available on our websites. We also have even more significant disclosure requirements in terms of having public meetings. All of our meetings are open to the public and noticed, so that the public can come and as much in the way you need to public notice your meetings, and then I'll also have to just disclose a lot of information about ways we are meeting the needs of the community. So all that exists. We also are evaluated by sort of organizations that look at charitable organizations to look at the balance between how much of your resources go into your fundraising administrative costs, and how much goes into programmatic work, and all of us exceed the sort of the requirements of those standards that are set by nonprofit organizations.
Mr. Chairman, if I might add to Representative Green, over the years, State Government Finance Committee has asked for this kind of information, specifically what our budgets are, how much money we get from the state of Minnesota, and operational costs, grant costs, what the salaries of CEOs are. We've always disclosed that information whenever we've been asked. So it's readily available. We're very excited about being a partner with the state of Minnesota. And I just want to add one thing, if I might, Mr. Chairman. Public television is sort of unique in Minnesota. We were started as 501c3.